All right, we're in parallel world, continuing on with our C++ AMP investigation, and now we're with the people who actually implemented this. So we're going to start with you. Dan, you've been on Channel 9 before, but go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, I was on Channel 9 about a couple of years ago. I'm Don McCready. I'm the dev lead for C++ AMP, and you may have seen me in a couple of videos around the concurrency runtime and PPL.
Yes, which is PPL being a big part of C++ AMP, right?
Yeah. We sit in the same namespace as PPL and Concert, and we try to play nice with them in terms of orthogonality.
Excellent. We have a bunch of other developers in the room, so please introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Simon Lubrański, and I'm a dev on the C++ AMP team.
Cool.
Hi, my name is Wei Rong. I'm also a dev on the C++ AMP team. I was the once being Channel 9 for the STM interview.
Nice, that's right. Ah, poor old STM. It was a noble idea.
Hi, I'm Amit Agarwal, and I primarily work on the C++ AMP runtime and generating debug info in the compiler backend.
Nice.
Yeah, my name is Charles Fu. I joined the CPR team a few months ago. I also work on the performance and some stuff.
Cool, great name.
Hi, my name is Steve Dietz. I joined AMP at the same time as Charles did, working on performance and the front end.
Cool.
Hello, my name is Lin Li Zhang, and I mainly work on the front end, and I also in the STM Channel 9 interview.
Of course, right on. Nice to see you again. Yeah, I just had Simon Peyton Jones on Channel 9 not too long ago, and he's still sort of bummed that didn't work out. It works in Haskell, though. Yeah. All right, so talk to us. So we talked to Yossi, we talked to Daniel, and we got the Yossi broke things down to little boxes and basically told us how this works from the front end down to the back end, generating all the gook that this GPU actually understands.
Right.
So you want to take us through and kind of crack through the process a little bit?
Sure. People on this team have to fill a variety of shoes, as you might have heard from that introduction. We have people that need to work on the C++ front end, because we need to consume the new language extensions that we've added to C++ AMP. We have people that need to work on the back end, because they need to consume that information and generate code that interacts with the DirectX compiler, and there's a runtime supporting it. Of course, we have debuggers that support it, and people that support that, and of course, the whole purpose of the product is for performance, so we've had people really banging on it to make sure that it had the right performance too.
So what were some of the hardest problems that you guys had to solve? I mean, that's your job, you solve hard problems. So maybe take us through on the front end, right? What were some of the hard problems there?
Sure. So we actually started with a programming model in the front end that was really simple and not very impactful to the overall type system. Ling Li was there during this exercise. Ling Li actually tried out lots of different proposals for the restriction syntax that we ended up coming to. She tried them out, she implemented them in the front end, she said this doesn't work at all, she gave us a lot of feedback, and we went around and came to the syntax that we have today. So Ling Li can talk a little bit about the kinds of stuff she did there.
So as Don mentioned, we actually start from a very simple mechanism, the DecoSpec, right? It works for the restriction part. Like, you know, if you put a DecoSpec, back then we called D3D maybe?
Vector.
DecoSpec vector, and then we can do the checking of the body. But the problem is, the DecoSpec part, one, it's very Microsoft specific, and two, it's not part of function overloading. So we do want to have function overloading enabled, because you might write some function, one for CPU version, one for GPU, and maybe you have another restriction, maybe for SSE or other version. So we do want the overloading part to work. So we end up with the restriction specifier, which is part of function signature. And the whole function overloading resolution will do consider that if you have a full function with restricted CPU, and you have another full with identical signature, like a return type, and then the parameter identical, but to have a restriction AMP, then these two is considered two function. And sure. Yeah, so if you have another function, you have the restriction amp, then if it call a foo, it actually will invoke the restriction amp version instead of call the restriction CPU version. Mm. So that's end up very nicely. And also, very interesting part is what if it has, we want to enable code sharing. Some function maybe not necessarily have two versions. You can share, right? It's not specific for CPU or GPU like add. You can have one function can be called by both version. So that function we want sharing in the source level. So you have this restriction CPU and amp part as a function. Say I'm good for CPU and amp both. For that particular function, it's kind of like a sharing at source level. And if you have another two function want to share that, then we want to generate two versions of that function because the code's lower layer of that function for the GPU and for the CPU will be different.
Sure.
So we end up do the symbol splitting. Like it's like working like a template. You have one version and then split in the lower layer and the front end actually take care of all this. And we even done to the decorate function name, all this is cracked open. Yes, yeah. That's very interesting and the challenging part.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, for us up at the compositional layer, it's just a word.
Yeah.
Restrict and throw one or more things in it. It's amazing what actually has to happen.
And also, it's quite general. It's not just for AMP. AMP is one application we use there, right? Wow. It has some extension down the road. You maybe introduce restricted PU. Then you can the compiler can start to do all the checking for the pure function in the future. So
that
it's quite general.
So restrict pure.
Yeah, that's something in our mind.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. I mean, if it is a language edition, it should have more than just one specific domain for use. Very cool. So I'm going to turn back to you. I guess you're going to be the maestro today.
I guess so.
So now after you've done your front end magic, and let's say I use restrict AMP or restrict GPU. In other words, I want to take advantage of parallelization over
right.
the GPU.
So that's restrict AMP.
Restrict AMP. Take us through what happens and what these people have to do to make it happen right.
Okay, well, to actually generate code out of the back end, we actually talk to the DirectX layer, and we do that through a compiler that you can already use today called FXC, the D3D compiler.
Okay.
So what ends up happening is we consume the C++ code and we produce HLSL. And then we run the HLSL through the compiler, through the HLSL compiler, and out comes Direct3D bytecodes. And those bytecodes get stored in the DLL or executable that you're building, and they get loaded at runtime and jitted and interpreted by the driver. So we wrong did all that work.
So we pointed the camera at you.
Yeah, so there was another piece of front-end work we haven't talked about yet. Restrict AMP tell you what function can be called from the GPU or for the accelerators, but how to enter that accelerator word. That's through something called parallel for each, which will be expanded. So I'm going to go straight to the backend part, but we will go back to this. Now, frontend give the backend a special function, which is generated from the parallel for each, and specially annotated so the backend knows this is the entry function for the GPU word. Then the next thing we do is we inline all the function in that call graph to make it a single function. In the backend IR or intermediate representation.
Okay.
So that's basically because on today's GPU, there's really no real function call. There's no real call stack. So we inline everything. And that also give us the possibility for doing the whole program analysis to support pointers. Mm. So basically, we are going from C++ to HSL. HSL is a C-like language, but without pointers.
Mm.
Then we need to, but C++ is pointer rich.
Sure.
And everything is like working behind the scenes, pointers. And we do need to support it and also help our user to port the C program or C++ program they have.
Yeah.
So then after inlining, we have the whole program visible to the backend compiler. By the whole program, I mean every function calls in that call graph.
Okay.
And then we do the point to analysis to decide if there's a point, what it points to. And based on that information, we do point. We did a technique called a pointer emulation, which basically we emulate every pointer in your code with two values. One is what it points to, which is a tag. Another is what's the offset. So when we really have a pointer dereference, according to the pointer, the point to set of that pointer, we will generate a switch to select the code to be executed. In most of the case, if you don't write a divergent code, which is highly encouraged in the GPU, it's just going to be a single instruction there to do the direct. You don't see, there's no actual control flow there. So after, okay, this is one thing we need to do, is we need to emulate pointers. Another thing is HSL doesn't support any unstructured control flow. It only supports like a structure like for loop and if else, and some you still have some unconditional jump like break and continue or return, but you cannot go to anywhere of your program. So, but C++, especially in the backend representation, is full of those go-to stuff. Even okay. You don't write go-to in your program.
Okay.
And we need to recover the control flow into a structured control flow. That's another important thing. After that is done, we emit the HSL code. So it's kind of strange. It's like normally, what the backend compiler will do at this stage is try to encode the instruction to lower it to machine code. What we do is actually, we call it reason. Because we reason back to a source code like called HSL. But we use HSL pretty much like assembly code. We don't use lots of functionality like HSL, but we treat it as assembly code. Then we generate all those code, source code, then ship it to FXC compiler or the D3D shader compiler, which generates the shader bytecode. And then we embed the shader bytecode in the text section with a contract that the runtime later can find the shader we generated for a particular parallel for each. Then the shader is the virtual machine we are having here. The HSL bytecode is the virtual machine we are having here. It's up to each vendor, the hardware vendor, to use their JIT compiler generated into the machine code at the runtime.
I see.
So that's pretty much the flow from the front end to the back end.
Interesting. Very interesting. Seems like the GPU is almost like a managed environment.
There's some terms in common, like JIT. You know, so the first time you execute your parallel for each, there's going to be a cost of translating your DirectX bytecodes into NVIDIA bytecodes or AMD bytecodes that can actually execute on the hardware.
Sure.
One of the things I wanted to mention, keying off what Ling Li said about functions that had multiple restrictions, is this actually was driven by a feature that we worked on with AMD, in fact, called the math library. Mm. It doesn't sound like much. It seems like you need to have this to even have a product, but it was actually more difficult than you might expect. If you could call cosine from a restrict amp program, which version of the cosine function were you going to get? Mm. Obviously, if you were being called from a parallel for each that was going to run on an accelerator, you want the cosine function for the accelerator for the GPU to be selected. And if you called it from, just an ordinary function call on the CPU, you'd want the standard C library's cosine to be called. And we actually did a lot of work to enable functions like cosine and sine and cosh and sinh and all those crazy transcendental functions to exist. We got a lot of help from our partners at AMD. So a big shout out to AMD for helping us out. And Simon actually did a lot of the work that integrated their math library into our CodeGen.
Nice.
Right.
Take it away.
It away, Simon.
So as Don mentioned, if we have a function that is restricted with AMP, we are not able to call the cosine function that would be not restricted with AMP. We have to call the function that obeys all these restrictions. So what we do is that we have all these signatures for all these math functions that we would provide. And we have the math library in HSL, and we would inject that code to your program. So if you use cosine function, you would end up injecting some HSL code that was highly optimized for the GPU for your target device. And therefore, the code that you would execute might have different precision than the cosine that you would execute on the CPU. But most of the cases, we deliver pretty good precision. And we measure that constantly and see how we measure against the oracle on the CPU.
Now, for people who may not know why there would be a difference between sine on a CPU and sine on a GPU, can you elaborate a little bit for the audience?
Well, it's different codes. And depending on how many operations do you perform to compute a sine, you would get different precision. So as you do different operations on floating points, you accumulate some error. And if you can do it with, depending on what strategy you would use, you would get better or worse precision.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons, since this is a quiet side over here, and you had mentioned that these are the performance people, right? At least some of them.
Yep.
I mean, the only reason you're going to use... is this a fair statement? I mean, the only reason you're going to want... GPU is most useful for crunching a bunch of data quickly.
Yes.
In parallel.
Yes.
And so you want performance. Otherwise, I'll just use a CPU, because it's not doing that much most of the time anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me a little bit about the performance characteristics of this V1 and some of the challenges you guys had in ensuring that it was as fast as one would hope, and where it needs to go, and stuff like that. So,
do you want to see? Yeah, so I mean, there are basically two main aspects of C++ AMP. The first is the code that we generate, which is targeted for the GPU, right? And we did some work around making sure that we generate optimized code, which can execute efficiently on the GPU. And the second aspect is the runtime, where now we have, like, I don't know if Daniel and Yossi did touch upon that, but we have our types that wrap around the DirectX runtime layer, like arrays, which basically contain data, and array views, which basically give you, isolate you, or abstract away the location sensitiveness of data. So we had to make sure that we perform efficiently both in the runtime and in the code gen. So, like, Charles and Steve actually did a bunch of performance studies and helped us identify problem areas and introduce new features where they needed to be, or fix issues where we had them.
Sure.
Yeah. So maybe Charles and Steve can talk a little bit about the performance study.
Yeah, so just following the Amit's the talks. So one of the issues, basically, if you look at the from app to the GPU, right, there's a lot of resource will be reused, like shaders, right? So you don't want to recompile those shaders, so they basically cache those ones, and also have data, right? The data will be when you pass from CPU to GPU. Sometimes you will always want to reuse the data, right? So do like dynamic programming, right? So basically multi-pass problem, you have data, have CPU, you pass to GPU, but you modify some data in the CPU, you also reuse them. So basically we also cache all those resources, shaders resource. So basically we can reduce the overhead. So that's one of the issues related to the runtimes. And also, Steve and I, we work on the infrastructure. We have to make sure the code generated from app to the HSL, because we build on top of HSL, had to be compatible or better than HSL, right? Mm. So this over upper bound, so there. So we make sure the code quality at least close to HSL or even better. So to make it better, definitely we can say rechange the code structures, not generate exactly the same code as we manually write the code. So we have different code structures. Or at least we make them the same. Yeah. So still have one way make the systematic ways. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So when we joined the AMP team a few months ago, we focused on a performance study where we wanted to make sure that the AMP code you generate is just as fast as the HSL code that you could write as well. So we've got a Perl script together that you could basically write. You basically write one file, and then from there we would generate HSL and AMP, and that way we knew that they were identical. Mm-hmm. So that one of the real advantages to AMP is that you don't have to write, is that it's just writing, it's the code you write is just C++, and it's just part of your C++ program, and you don't end up writing a lot of code that is going to transfer all the data to the GPU, which accounts for, a large percentage of the HLSL code you write. The kernel itself is actually very similar between the AMP and the HLSL. So we could get a script that just makes sure that those are the same, and then we wrote on, I guess if you count all the variations of benchmarks, probably a few hundred different benchmarks to see how our performance stacked up.
So what were some of the bottlenecks that you guys found early on, like in terms of performance? I mean, where are some examples of, whoa,
okay, that's one at least we work on. Like that one benchmark of Flyer Washoe. Mm-hmm. Flyer Washoe, basically the problem is to compute the shortest path in a graph, basically. You compute the shortest path between any of two nodes, right? Find the shortest path. That's the problem. So that problem basically is like dynamic programming problem. We found basically from this infrastructure, basically, if we can cache the resource, at that time we call constant buffer. Constant buffer is one of the resources in HLSL. So basically, you pass the parameters to your program. So like, say, number of iterations. So those one basically is a constant buffer to the HLSL. So if we cache those one, we can reduce from how much one of the customer code, like 300?
About 30 times, I think, yeah.
Yeah. 30 improvement about 30 times. Yeah, 30 times faster, yeah. Yes. So. Yeah.
So this is specifically for problems which actually involve multiple kernel invocations. And there is some resources that we were earlier creating upon each kernel invocation, and we found out that this resource creation itself was like contributing to a huge, significant portion of the overall runtime. Mm-hmm. So Charles actually did some analysis around that, and we found out that if we could actually cache the resource and in an intelligent manner reuse it where possible, we found some real significant performance improvements there. Another example is like there's some work that Virang did early on with caching the jitting of the shader. So we basically use a high-level shader language and generate code targeted to the HLSL virtual machine. And this code can actually now run portably across hardware vendors. But since the final code actually needs to run specific hardware, and each of them have their own assembly language, so there is this final runtime stage of translating this bytecode into the hardware-specific assembly format. And this can actually be a significant portion of the runtime. So we did some work around jitting it once and caching that information, the jitted shader, and reuse it every time.
So if you call the same kernel multiple times, you're going to get benefit.
Yes. Yes. So you end up paying the jitting price just once. Yeah.
Nice.
Another one is the copy, right? So staging buffer copies as well, right? So that's basically, if we can encourage the user to use, because the copies from CPU to GPU, you have goes through PCI Express path, right? So that's basically one of the bottleneck to these computations. So there's one buffer called staging buffer. So if the user can use a staging buffer, so basically also improve our performance, yeah.
Right.
Even the code gen also make a difference, right? What kind of HSO we generate, signed or unsigned?
Yeah. So yeah, one thing I didn't mention is so our front end is using the existing C++ front end. Our back end also using the existing VC++ back end, which has been around there for 20 years, which means actually has a lot of optimization built in there. Mm. And we actually also take advantage of all those, not all of them, all the optimization that's applicable to the GPU. We also run those optimizations, then optimize the code before we generate the HSL code. So basically, we optimize the code and generate the HSL code, and the FX, again, optimize it based on its domain knowledge of the graphics. So we do the general optimization, FX do the domain-specific optimization. Then that's the code we actually ship. So sometimes the code quality can actually be better than what your handwritten HSL. But whether it matters or not is a problem by problem base. Mm-hmm. Because on the GPU, for example, if it's a memory bound problem, even let's say one version with 20 instructions, one version with 30 instructions, you may not see any performance difference. Mm. It's very problem dependent.
Sure.
Right. And the things like inlining and the whole program optimization that we do in the back end, or the pointer emulation, for example. right? It's a C++ compiler backend infrastructure that we use for actually emulating pointers, even if they are not natively supported on GPUs, in a restricted form, of course, which you might have heard from Daniel and Yossi earlier today.
But we didn't really dig into, I mean, the notion of emulated reference, right, to some location in memory on the GPU, what does that mean?
So
what is this software pointer? What exactly is it?
So imagine you as a C++ programmer or any programmer on the CPU side, you're actually assuming you have a flat memory model, a continuous address space. No matter where your object is, it's on stack or on the heap, you can hold a pointer to access it in this unified address space.
Okay.
And on HSL, we don't have pointers. Everything needs to be accessed by a name.
So it's a fragmented address
yes.
space, right? Where you have registers, you have shared memory, you have global memory. So it's actually multiple address spaces.
Yes. So basically, what we do is we need to map to this multiple fragmented address space from give you the impression you're still working with a flat memory model.
Unified address space. Right.
Okay. Yes. So then basically, for us, HSL, all those objects in HSL is a bunch of resources. Each of them has its own address space. And that's why when I talk about our point is actually composed of two things. One is the offset within this resource. Another is a tag to infer which resource I'm actually pointing to.
Okay.
So in case there's no ambiguity, I know exactly which resource I'm pointing to. I'm just generating a code to load or store to that resource. In case there is ambiguity, then I need to generate the code to dynamically select which one I'm going to I'm going to point to.
Right. So in the CPU, you have the single number, which is basically an address. It's a virtual address, and you can use that to access any memory location you want. On the GPU, otherwise, you have these different memory areas that I talked about: registers, shared memory, global memory. So, we kind of break this address into a two-component thing. The first component identifies which address space you're talking about, and the second component is the offset within that particular address space. And Wirang does all the points to analysis to make sure that we can efficiently dereference pointers.
Yeah, and this is not only challenging for the backend coding, this is also challenging for the debug information generation.
Right.
Amit can talk more about that.
Yeah. How is it? Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Right, so debugging basically... debugging is basically, a compiler translates your source-level program into the target machine code. But when you actually are trying to identify a problem, you want to deal with things at the source level. And what debug info essentially is that it actually captures all the information necessary to maintain the mapping between the original source program and the final machine code that's generated by the compiler. So the key challenges in generating debug info for C++ AMP were, the firstly is that we have a multi-stage compilation process. So we take the C++ source program and we convert it to HLSL, and then we pass it on to the HLSL compiler, which converts it to the bytecodes, right? So there is this two-stage compilation process, so there is two sets of debug information we have. And what we eventually want to show people is direct mapping between the C++ source program and the final bytecodes that are generated. Mm-hmm. So there is a step involved in combining this debug information and coming up with a set of consolidated debug information, if you will. The second key challenge is around that GPU codegen differs from CPU codegen in several ways. I mean, we are actually very close to optimized code generation. For example, as Wirang mentioned, we fully inlines everything. So if you have a function foo, which calls a function bar, the final code that gets generated, there are no function calls. Everything is inlined. But when you are debugging your program inside the debugger, you still want to see things in terms of the original source program that you wrote. So we generate debug information in a form where we can actually present this virtual call stack information back to the user inside the debugger. And for that, we capture some special debug information.
Great.
Then there are things around a lot of optimizations on CPU. Everything lives in memory, but on GPU, everything lives in registers. So the debug information differs a lot there. And then there are things around scoping of variables. On CPU, everything lives in memory. A stack frame lives for as long as that function executes. But since on the GPU, you are actually optimizing everything, and everything that's in registers, a variable effectively is only alive between the first and the last use of that variable. And we had to do some tricks around how to actually force that variable to remain alive for the entire scope, the C++ scope of the variable.
And the pointers.
And pointers, of course. So, you know, pointers, just that, just like as Virung has to deal with this. So in the backend, we maintain special information about, so for whenever you take an address of something, we basically remember which address space or which register or which memory region it points to in something called a tag. And each tag value has an associated name of the symbol that it corresponds to. So we had to keep corresponding information in the debug information also, so that we can actually do the switching or dereferencing of pointers inside the debugger.
Yeah, you imagine you want to dereference inside the debugger for a pointer which in the program will never dereference.
Right.
So now the lambda is the kernel in the GPU speak, and then is the lambda the tag? So in other words, you have to be guaranteed that the code running in a lambda is, in some sense, shared nothing environment, right?
When they're talking about tags for pointers, one of the things that you can capture into the lambda are arrays. And if you capture two arrays, A and B, those two arrays will get unique tags. Let's say A is tag 1 and B is tag 2. And now if you take the address of one of the variables, A, or one of the elements of A and B, the pointer analysis that Weirong needs to do needs to remember that, okay, you're taking an address from A, so the pointer it'll generate will have tag 1 with an offset of 50 because he's accessing the 50th element.
Okay.
And that's what gets dereferenced. If you dereference it later, the code generator will actually translate that into a dereference of buffer A at offset 50. And if you'd taken the address of buffer B at offset 100, we'd have generated code to dereference B at offset 100. And if you had taken the address of both and the points to analysis couldn't tell the difference, then you'd see a switch. You'd say, well, switch on the tag, and if the tag is 1, then dereference A at offset 50. Or if the tag is 2, then dereference tag 2 at offset 100. So it's a dynamic code generation. It can incur some performance, but as Weirong suggests, this divergent code generation pattern is frowned upon anyway for performance reasons, and very often we can just deduce that this pointer can only ever point to A at offset 50, so we can get rid of the switch entirely.
Nice. Excellent. Now, I was in talking with Yossi. He mentioned, obviously, that, how many of you here implemented sort of the library? The template metaprogramming magic, is that you?
No. So Yossi did a lot of it, and Amit did a lot of it, and Ling Li pitched in a little bit, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's just template metaprogramming is something we don't cover enough of. There's only so many people that can do it quite well. and a lot of thanks from everyone else who gets a benefit from that complexity.
Ling Li can probably go through a quick list of what we don't support, because the list of things that we do support is huge.
Of course. Yeah. All right, so what are some of the things you can't do inside a restrict?
If I can remember them correctly. So basically, the first part is type, what kind of type you cannot use. So we don't support short type, like char, short. The reason for that is the HSO does not have type less than 4 bytes. But we could emulate that, but that would actually impose some performance overhead, so we decide not to go there. But we do support bool, because bool is so fundamental. If you have if expression, there's a bool there. So then when you compose type together, we don't support, of course you cannot have like an array of char, because char is not supported, so it's recursive restriction, right? And also we don't support pointer to pointer, which actually we can support. But
pointer arithmetic, do you support that?
No, we don't. Yeah, there's something about whether you can support or whether you want to support.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. So like for pointer to pointer, we actually can support It just, if we support that, it's open the door, the user start use that, then because we emulate the pointer, this pointer emulation analysis will end up, we'll have a big switch maybe. So we decide, okay, that's some hole we don't want to open. It's like, we want to prevent.
The GPU architecture is not suited for pointer chasing kind of application. So we thought it's not a good idea anyway. So we limited ourselves to basic pointer support, which we thought was very useful for porting existing C++ code. But now the way we have designed it, we don't encourage patterns which are not suited to the GPU architecture, pointer to pointer.
Yeah,
being one of them.
That's one reason is we don't support them is to discourage the usage of them.
Sure. Right.
And also like a pointer reference inside the struct, we don't support that. And what else?
We do support the pointer arithmetic.
We do support pointer
arithmetic is totally fine.
It's totally supported.
But we don't support pointer arithmetic for bool.
Yes.
That's
right.
A little trick there.
Yeah. Okay.
Because
we also don't support the conversions from an int to a pointer.
And vice versa. Because that will kill the pointer emulation. Like if you have an int and then you convert to a pointer, then the pointer emulation was where are you come from, right? So
sure. Right.
Also we don't support the function pointer. Of course, because on GPU you don't have function call actually. And what else? What's the restriction?
No exception.
No exceptions.
That sounds like COM, man. COM is back. It's the COM Renaissance. It's not the C++ Renaissance. I got that wrong.
Yeah, but you won't see the COM Renaissance on the GPU.
No,
at least not yet.
Yeah. So many restriction is based on the hardware layer. What kind of hardware can support, and also maybe we'll put some restrictions, say, yeah, we see this is some pattern that we want to discourage or encourage.
This brings up a great point. So let's talk more about jumping into advanced. You give me all this great stuff for free, but I need more.
No, that's an excellent question. So, I mean, if you actually notice the way we have designed our parallel programming model is encourages, so you basically have to be aware of this new execution model from the outset. Mm-hmm. So you have this parallel for each, which has a compute domain with potentially millions of threads, which are executing the same piece of code in parallel. Mm-hmm. So that's your entry into the GPU, into the accelerator world, and so you have to be aware of the basic execution model at that point itself. And so we have this, we support this, we are what we call the naive model, in which, you know, there is no sharing of data between threads, except, of course, through global memory. And then we have this more advanced tiled model where you actually closely control how can threads share data between each other, because global memory is, reading data from global memory is expensive. It's high latency, high bandwidth memory. So whenever there is opportunity for sharing data across threads, you could load it once from global memory and share it across threads, which takes you to the more advanced model, which we call the tiled model. But yeah, you're very right that like you have to be very, very, very aware of the accelerator execution model and what kind of things it's suited to do. And in our programming model, we have attempted to actually make that very explicit. So you have to be, the program, it's in your face and what the execution model looks like and what kind of things would be efficient when you execute.
Now, what about like C++ 11? Since you're, you know, one of the things that you use in your list of why C++ AMP is so cool is because it supports modern C++ built on lambdas. You have to use lambdas, right? Or functors, but it looks like lambda is the way
you have to
do it because of the capture semantics and blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. But I would ask you, C++ 11 has a memory model. How does that impact your world? Like, can I use atomic inside of a restrict?
Yes,
you can.
Nice,
man. So
you guys are on point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the GPU, the C++ AMP memory model is pretty much close to what the official C++ 0x or 1x now?
11.
Yeah, 1.1. C++ 1.1's memory model is almost the same except for a few different places.
Okay.
So, but in general, you should understand like C++ memory model is a very relaxed memory model.
Mm.
If you don't do anything, the compiler, the hardware has a lot of freedom to do the optimization, to reordering the code. But we do offer memory fans. And the memory fans we offer is the both side memory fans. But it has both acquire and release semantics. And it applies to all the threads in the same tile.
Excellent.
It doesn't apply to all the threads across tiles. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's used for the synchronization between the thread and tile, and also it helps the compiler don't reorder the code.
The GPU architecture does not allow you to synchronize between threads across tiles. It's just a bad idea, just the way the hardware is designed.
And there's no safe way to do that.
And there's no safe way to do that.
Except for
otherwise running into the chances of...
But even for atomic, you need to be very careful. It's something you shouldn't do. Unless
you shouldn't do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can do, but...
So the difference between can do and should do.
Yes.
You can do, but probably it's not a good idea for most cases. You're very likely to run into deadlocks.
Understood.
And things like
but
that.
But I mean, this is native code. This is C++. You can do almost whatever you want.
Exactly.
You have to think through.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why would I do that? It's not a great idea.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to execute something on the GPU, you really want to write it with the GPU model in mind. So you have to optimize for tiles.
Okay.
Doing things that you break up your problem across these tiles and then have all the threads within a tile working together and don't do anything across the tiles.
No. Ideally, even independently.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, as we wind down here, because I'm sure you guys want to get back and write some more code or fix some bugs or whatever, because beta's out by the time this is out, so people are playing with it right now.
Yep.
And you guys have made some good advances in the beta. The question I would ask is, the bottleneck for all of this, of course, has to be memory. Or what I mean is, the data has to live somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And by moving that around is the bottleneck. So if
it
I have
be,
this,
yeah.
You're into astronomy, you take great pictures, everybody knows that by now, but that's a lot of data. That's an unbelievable amount of data, and that has to be a bottleneck in crunching that.
Right. So I guess in that sense, it's not terribly different from parallel programming in general. If you're doing only a little bit of crunching, it's not worth doing in parallel unless you're doing a lot of it. And especially if you're incurring, for GPGPU, especially if you're incurring an additional cost of going across a PCI Express bus, then the amount of computation you're doing on that data had better be enough to overwhelm that cost.
Mm-hmm.
And it very often is. So if you're doing a image processing like a convolution or something like that usually is sufficient to overwhelm that. Now, in terms of memory itself, GPUs actually have a healthy amount of memory these days. So, I don't think I could ever generate an image that is too big to fit on, the 1 gigabyte almost minimum 1 gigabyte GPUs that are out there.
Okay.
But you're right. Once it's on the card, it should stay on the card as long as possible. And if you're doing the dynamic programming that Charles was alluding to, then you need to be mindful about leaving it there too, so that you can re-enter or execute a different kernel on the data, and then when you're finished, come back and then execute another kernel on that data without ping-ponging the memory between the two memory systems.
So that's one important aspect. The other important aspect is that the GPU memory is high latency, high bandwidth, and which means typically on contemporary cards, one read is going to take around 500, 600 cycles. And you have to hide that latency somehow. And the way GPU architecture is designed is you have this millions of threads, and once one thread is actually processing a load or a store operation, which could potentially take 500 cycles, you could, with no cost, bring in another thread and continue doing work on that thread. It's kind of, think of it as the hyper-threading model that you have on CPUs, but instead of two threads, we are talking about like hundreds and thousands of threads, which can actually, as soon as one thread is processing a load or a store, you can bring in another thread and do that work.
Okay.
So this is basically the trade-off that GPUs make compared to CPUs. CPUs have this, this enormous cache hierarchy where they actually make a huge attempt to reduce the latency of memory access operations as much as possible. GPUs, on the other hand, they actually dedicate more resources to real compute units, and they depend on having millions of these threads to be able to hide the latency of memory operations.
And also, I think, you mentioned the big data, right? The big data sometimes won't be able to fit the GPU, so you can, from application point of view, or from developer point of view, right, you can basically lay out your data in different ways. Then you can chunk the data, then transfer to the GPU, overlap the computations with the transfers, so you can hide the overhead. And also, you can also have hybrid model, the CPU computation, the GPU computation, both together, right? Mm-hmm. So multiple ways you can do it to basically get high performance. Mm-hmm.
So there are several levels at which you need to manage this, right? The first is you want to minimize, so the PCIe bandwidth, like for a typical X16 card, 16-wide PCIe card, the bandwidth that you have in each direction is about 6 gigabytes per second. So that's a huge bottleneck. So once you get your data to the GPU, you better do a lot of work with it because you spent quite some time getting the data in and you'd probably spend an equal amount of time getting the data out. The second aspect is once you did get it onto the GPU, now you want to like make sure that your memory bandwidth does not become the bottleneck. So you make sure that your memory bandwidth is not the bottleneck by having enough threads to hide the latency. And in cases where you don't have enough threads, another alternative is using tiled static memory, which is, you know, as I said, GPUs don't have too much automatic caches like CPUs do, but you get some memory. And since it's a very valuable resource, the onus is on the programmer on how he makes the best use of this programmable cache. Because the programmer can make the best decision about reuse, right? CPUs try to approximate or, you know, guess which piece of data is most likely to be used next and cache it and like keep that around for as long as possible. On the other hand, GPUs caches are much more expensive. We have much more limited caches. So the onus is left onto the programmer because he knows best which piece of data is going to be reused next. So we let him control what lives in the cache and how things is kicked out to global memory.
Yeah, that's why this is also called a programmable cache.
Yes.
Okay. Now, even in the case where it just default, like I say, restrict AMP, then I do my Lambda, then I'm not actually physically managing a cache. I'm not using static tile or anything. So we were just talking about the advanced case. But I mean, the point is, the default that you get from C++ AMP makes it really simple. You guys do all the work, which is nice. But I can get down to that level as you were just describing. And
right.
I'm writing my own cache,
right.
Managing my own cache. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep.
We've used the term accelerators a lot. Mm-hmm. Neither Daniel nor Yossi really explained what an accelerator is. I mean, clearly, it's the device target.
Yeah.
But can you talk about accelerators a little bit?
Sure.
So we can say we did it.
Okay. You know, accelerators are exactly that. But we call them accelerators and not devices because we think that other things besides devices can be accelerators. Yeah. For example, your CPU. It could be an accelerator. Your CPU has vector units on it, which serve much the same function as the GPU vector units. We wanted to leave the door open for FPGAs and things like that, and massively multi-core systems coming from our friends at AMD and Intel. These things being accelerators. And I hope we can grow C++ AMP in future versions to incorporate that into a kind of a global view of something that you can run code on faster, accelerated.
Excellent.
Anything that fits to the massive parallelism, so AMP stands for accelerated massive parallelism.
Yes.
So any emulated or real hardware physical device which fits, which is a good fit for this programming model, we do plan to keep the doors open for those kind of devices, and that's why we use anything which can be used for which can support massive parallelism for accelerating your applications is something that can be potentially used as a AMP device.
Excellent.
With a different restrict or the same restrict.
Yeah.
Actually, also for performance, we also make sure for different vendors, AMD, NVIDIA, so the both app will have really good performance,
right.
Not just for one vendors. Yeah.
Cool. I mean, yeah, because the NVIDIA has CUDA, which is C, it's C. But this kind of democratizes GPGPU for native developers, and even managed developers can use it if you do your extern C stuff and give them an inroad to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a blog post you guys wrote about that. So for all the managed developers out there, they can get access to this through C++ AMP as well. My last question would be, when this gets to the cloud, what does that mean? So could this work very well and take full advantage of 100,000 cores?
today?
If your problem and data was large enough, if you were in a situation kind of like what Charles was alluding to, where your data didn't fit in one GPU and you wanted to split it across multiple GPUs, you could build on top of our programming model to do that. And if your data scales big enough that you want to imagine this scaling out even further into the cloud, you could do that too. We don't provide that infrastructure directly in our programming model, but we believe that we have enough basis there that you could do it. And I think you'll see a blog post from one of our team members in the near future talking a little bit about splitting a computation among multiple GPUs.
Great, because I know the alien boxes I've seen in people's offices, those have two. Right?
They can't have two.
So for normal people who today may have two or four, it works great.
Even two different cards.
Really?
Yeah.
Totally seamless. Mm-hmm.
Totally seamless.
Nice.
So you basically, today, as we have in our programming model, you explicitly manage the distribution of data across multiple GPUs, and you manage how you distribute your data, you manage how you distribute your computations. I guess what you were referring to is scaling out to the cloud and having illusion of a single accelerator, which is which effectively is thousands of GPUs running in the background. So
sure.
As of today, we our programming model provides you the basis to do that, but we don't do it for you right now. And we'll shortly be publishing a blog post on how you'd actually chunk data across multiple places and manage the scheduling.
And you have to be careful too. I just want to point out that on some computers, especially AMD, you have their little Fusion embedded chips, and then you have a discrete card as well. And it would be a mistake to divide your problem into two and just ship one to each accelerator, because they're not equal power, and you'll end up being limited by the slowest of them. Mm-hmm. So you do have to consider the capabilities of your hardware when you're splitting data.
Interesting. But in the case of Azure, let's use that as an example, we know what the hardware is going to be. We own the infrastructure. All the blades are going to be exactly the same. I mean, today it has to be x64. It has to have certain specifications. That's not, in this case, you can shove GPUs in there, and then we know what they are.
Then the math is simple.
Then the math is simple.
Divide by n.
Divide by n.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. But that's out of scope.
Yeah.
Great work, you guys. Very interesting. And I look forward to see what customers are going to do with this. And it's nice to know that, at least today, anywhere you're running Windows with DirectX 11, we're going to be able to use this great stuff.
You have this enormous compute power sitting idle on your chip. And our purpose is to make that easily accessible to all C++ programmers. And it's up to them. They can use the power of PPL. They use the power of C++ AMP and do wonderful things.
Right on. Go native, man.
Go native.
Take care, you guys.
Thanks, Charles.
Cheers.
Thanks.